Hey, before we start this episode, just want to remind you that the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business is available everywhere that you like to buy books, and you can get it in paperback, Kindle, and even as an audiobook. I'll have links on where you can purchase in the podcast notes. Okay, back onto the show.
You are listening to One Broken Mom, a podcast dedicated to raising awareness about mental health, parenting, and self-improvement. I'm the host, Ami Quirconi. One Broken Mom is not a family show. It is intended for adults only and may contain adult language. Sometimes the topics are serious, but you can count on the episodes to be entertaining. Also, One Broken Mom is not offering any psychiatric or medical diagnosis. We're just here giving away useful and important information. So, if you're ready to hear real talk by real people so that we can all get better together, then you're in the right place, and welcome. So, I'm really happy today to actually have back on One Broken Mom, Veronique Mead. If any of you caught my episode where we talked about the impacts of childhood trauma and chronic illness, then you'll know that Veronique is an expert in the area out here in the United States in terms of being able to compile the vast amount of research that there is around chronic illnesses, pain, several of the diseases, including the one that I have, rheumatoid arthritis, and all the studies worldwide that have shown some relationships between childhood traumas to the individuals who end up developing chronic illnesses. And I'm having her back on today to talk specifically about rheumatoid arthritis, which I'd shared in that episode is the particular ailment that cropped up in my body about 5 years ago. And we're doing this for a couple of reasons. One is, I believe it was February 2nd. Is that correct, Veronique? That was rheumatoid arthritis awareness day.
And just to name, because she emphasizes this so hugely, she actually emphasizes it as rheumatoid disease.
Okay.
Awareness
okay.
Day.
Okay. We're recording this on February 6th. I'll probably bump this up in my schedule to release this. And so when you guys are listening to this, you're listening to it ahead of schedule because I want to move this into February. And I wanted to talk specifically because, like with all these episodes that I've done with One Broken Mom, I'm always learning something amazing myself. And my conversation with Veronique tipped me off to some new information for myself in terms of cell danger response. We talked about our danger arousal systems that we have. And so after that conversation, we did that in December, I believe is when we talked. Mm-hmm. And I then took that information and began to observe my own environment very differently and a little bit more focused. And so now that I have some new information, I was like, oh my gosh, like I'd love to get you back on the show and let's talk about this specifically because I do know people with RA. There's a handful of them that I actually grew up with and, you know, mm-hmm. from my hometown. I've had a number of women since you published the blog just a week ago that have reached out to me that also have RA. Mm-hmm. And there is a trend and theme. And so what I'm hoping that comes out at the end of this episode is I want to hear from anyone out there that's listening that wants to share some stories. I attempted to do this a year ago. I wanted to do a survey. I wanted to collect data from other RA people and to find out what our common histories are and kind of compile it together in a very, you know, a conscientious way. I'm not a researcher in a medical facility or in a university. I'm just a person who, just like everybody else, always just, I want to know why. And so at the end of this episode, I will talk about a link on my website to a very brief survey, not the one that Veronique, you looked at before, which was like 17 pages. Sorry, that's not happening. But I think based on the conversation today, we'll come up with what are the questions that I would love to hear from other people to see if that's actually some links in there. Because I don't like having the disease or ailment, whatever word. I always say I don't, I am conscious of my words. You know, I'm not RA. RA is happening to me at the moment, but I don't expect it to be a defining piece of my life forever. Like that's why my brain is into wanting to understand this. And so, but the last conversation that we had, again, was eye-opening. It was astonishing for me. And so I'm glad, Veronique, that you're back on with me today. And we're doing this in video because as I talked about before, I know not a lot of you actually listen to podcasts, but I'm hoping some of you that are out there researching this on YouTube or just doing a Google search for like RA and why do I have it and where does it come from? Mm-hmm. We'll find, our conversation here today. And yesterday, this is relevant. I actually went to see my rheumatologist, and if any of you who have the, you know, the ailment will know, you can't really get into a meaty conversation with your doctor or your rheumatologist because you got about 15 minutes with them, and they might be really nice people, but you know, wanting to talk about what might be the psychology behind or what might be your trauma history is a conversation that no one ever is able to have, in my opinion, you know, with, you know, with their RAs. And I think that you probably know that as well, right, Veronique?
Yeah.
Yeah. So today we're going to talk about RA and some of the connections in there. Let's go back for anybody jumping in here. Give us a little bit of a breakdown on what you have seen kind of overarching in terms of the research that you've coalesced together when it comes to rheumatoid arthritis and the chronic illness.
What I would say is the big perspective that I use and that I've been finding over the past 20 years is thinking of chronic illness, autoimmune diseases, RA or RD, as they sometimes call it now, because there's so many more symptoms than just the arthritis piece for a lot of people, is, as one researcher in multiple sclerosis put it, it's a chronic disease is like an undersea volcano that grows very slowly out of awareness over time, potentially for years, potentially for over decades, and that there are a number of different kinds of either adverse experiences or missing experiences that affect how the nervous system works, that affect our genes and how they function, and that actually increase our risk for developing a chronic disease. And then the final stressor, the final event, is what tips it over the edge, over the ocean, so that it peaks out above that. And that's where all of a sudden the symptoms of a disease start.
One of the things that I know from the last conversation, you know, in that episode, I shared how you called it the kindling, right? So I shared the story of how the disease in me, you know, kind of retroactively looking at it and how it started to build. And then it did peak with a stressful event. And then from that point forward, I began to notice, it took me a couple of years to start to link out an external stress to a flare up in the body. And it's hard sometimes to identify that, especially if you're taking medications to regulate the disease, that, you know, if the medication's working, then you aren't experiencing pain, right? Or you're experiencing less of it. But it was the, when I started to really put it together and go, man, this is definitely stress related, that there's something that's going on. Now, stress is this big, wide word, right? So stress means a variety of things. Was it stress with my kids? No, it wasn't that. Was it stress at work? Yeah, sometimes it was. Was it stress with my partner? Yeah, it was that. But, you know, still not being able to kind of narrow it in. And you had talked about the research around cell danger response. And that's what kind of like my, you know, the light bulb in my brain started to work. And I was like, okay, now I'm going to go out into the world and really start to think about what is this concept of cell danger response. So can you touch on that again? I know you're not the one doing the research, but I'd like the description of what we mean by that cell danger response. And also that arousal system, our innate response to danger when we're confronted with danger. So can you walk everybody through just that piece of that?
So I think of it in two different parallel sets of research. The cell danger response is the research of Dr. Robert Navio. He's a medical doctor who is a geneticist, virologist, and has a mitochondrial research lab at UC San Diego. He's pulled together research from 50 or 60 years looking at how our cells function and has done some research. Like, one of his studies was on chronic fatigue, which is the chronic illness that I've had for 20 years. And what he's finding is that the mitochondria in our cells, we tend to be familiar with the sense that mitochondria are our energy producers. But he says they also have a function in protecting our cells and our bodies from danger. So that can be infections or toxins. And what they do in when they have a sense that there's a threat is they help the cell or tell the cell to release ATP, adenosine triphosphate, also something we think of and know about in medicine and sort of in general culture to be molecules that provide energy or support having energy. But the ATP he's discovered in the research is also a, the other function is also cell danger. And what ATP does is when it leaves the cell in these circumstances is it signals the other cells that there's danger or threat. And then that provides or sends a, begins a cascade of events that the cells use to protect themselves. They may strengthen their boundaries to keep infections out. They may stop communicating with other cells as a way to prevent something like infection from spreading. But it also happens in with psychological threats as well. So he talks about in one of his videos, I have a clip on one of my blog posts on the cell danger response, but he talks about how if you run into the proverbial tiger or the bear in the woods, that fight-flight system that gets triggered in you is happening at a cellular level, and that causes ATP to be released. The big thing that he's saying in his perspective, and he's talking about this as a new paradigm of disease, is that this is what is causing and driving the symptoms of over 100 diseases. He lists these, and the autoimmune diseases are part of those, like rheumatoid disease and type 1 diabetes, lupus, multiple sclerosis. And so what I found when I discovered his research and his publications is it linked to what I've learned in studying polyvagal theory, the nervous system from a trauma therapist's perspective, which is that we think of the nervous system as having two branches, a sympathetic nervous system branch, which is what tells our system to go into fight or flight if we need to, but that also helps our bodies run or stand up or simply be active. There's a healthy role that we play in every day, and there's the fight flight when things get kicked up a notch or three. And then there's the parasympathetic system, which helps the body to relax or digest or sleep. And those are the two parts of the nervous system that we're most familiar with and that we're trained in as doctors as well. But what I've learned in my own training as a trauma therapist is that the parasympathetic branch appears to have two branches. And this is the work of Stephen Porges in what's called polyvagal theory or multiple vagus nerves. Those are the two parts of the nerves for the parasympathetic nervous system. So can I add one more piece here? Because I know I'm providing a lot of information.
No, get it all out there.
This is kind of the basic foundation here.
Right.
Yeah, so the parasympathetic branch, the vagus nerve, really has two branches and two functions. And so when we talk about rest, digest, or tend and befriend, we're actually talking about a part of the nervous system that is able to help us cope or deal with threat in the most energy efficient way possible. And that's through connection, communication. It's about using our gaze and making eye contact with someone. It's about speaking to someone to say, no, I don't want to do this. That's setting a boundary. That's one way that we can protect ourselves and deal with some potential sources of threat. In this view of the nervous system, what we find is that it's not as if we have to be in balance one or the other. It's more of a ladder or hierarchy. So in a really healthy system, if we experience threat at work, let's say our boss is kind of being a bit obnoxious, we might try to communicate or say something and say, no, I really don't want to do this. This is not okay. We'll use the social nervous system, this branch of the vagus. But if that doesn't work, we're going to get a bit triggered potentially into the next level of protection that our bodies have, and that's the fight-flight system. And so we might get kind of irritable with the boss. That's a bit of a fight response. Or we might actually have a rage response or need to suppress that. And our social nervous systems help us suppress or inhibit these kind of reactions that aren't appropriate in certain circumstances. So that's actually a function of this social nervous system. It can inhibit fight or flight, so we can keep trying to communicate and do what we need to do. But if you're out in the woods and you run into that tiger, you're not going to talk your way out of this thing. So your social nervous system isn't going to be a good option for survival. And as a human being, we're generally not big enough or fast enough to fight the tiger or flee. So our sympathetic nervous system isn't enough either. And that's where our bodies will default to the other branch of the nervous, of the parasympathetic nervous system. And this is a vagus nerve also. And it's talked about as the dorsal vagal nerve, or being in a dorsal vagal state. That has to do with the freeze response. So that's when you immobilize, things actually shut down, they get very quiet. And that way of responding to threat is used by opossums. They don't have the strength or the agility to fight predators, so they actually play dead. And the big misconception is that it's not faked. We're not actually doing this on purpose. We're not planning to go into freeze. Our nervous systems do this outside of our conscious awareness. And so it's actually a state of shutdown, literal physiological shutdown, where your eyes might actually kind of glaze over a bit. Your blood pressure will go down. Your heart rate can go down. In the wild, an animal looks and actually seems to be dead. And that fakes out the predator in case they have, the animal has a moment in which they could escape. Mm-hmm. So in this hierarchy, if that moment to escape arises, the clamp from the nervous system releases, the freeze is sort of unlocked, and we go into fight flight so that we can escape. But that's what happens to the gazelle in the wild that's being chased by the cheetah. So the way this applies to chronic disease is it's the cell danger response is what happens, I think, at the cellular level, and the fight flight freeze is what happens at the nervous system level. If we have escaped past traumas successfully, it conveys the message to the brain that the threat is over, and that our bodies and our nervous systems and our cells and our cell danger responses can come back to baseline and go on with the job of digesting and sleeping and resting and connecting. Mm-hmm. If that response, that ability to escape gets stuck or we get frozen, then the nervous system doesn't get the message that the threat's over. And that's where what we talked about briefly as kindling can happen. So what happens is if we have experiences that leave us in some relative degree of helplessness, that triggers the freeze response in the nervous system. So that can happen, let's just say, as a really overt example with child abuse. Given that a child can't fight off the adult, they can't talk their way out of this, and they really can't escape. And so that's where a child might end up looking at themselves while this is happening, as if they're on the ceiling in the room or from the doorway. That's a freeze response. It's a dissociation response that helps numb out our bodies so that we can kind of get through the intolerable. If that kind of thing happens and we don't have a sense of having escaped, and if it goes on more than once or multiple times or even that one time, that's a sort of like a hit on the nervous system. And it can start this cell danger response of perception of threat and a pathway where the nervous system, the body, kind of starts to orient towards some direction of a threat response because the world is no longer seen as safe. What happens in the research that I've been seeing from the trauma science, but also in the cell danger response and other bodies of research, is that it's not usually this one exposure, one event, like a car accident, that causes any particular thing to get stuck. It's a series of events or hits over time. And what we're seeing in chronic disease is that this is something that happens very likely for decades, and that may begin during pregnancy if our mothers have had experiences of really significant stress or even serious illness, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So the nervous system and the cell danger response get stuck in a perception of threat. And as that undersea volcano, that's what gets started with these. And it, if we have more exposures, ongoing exposures to other things, then that pathway increases in strength. And at some point, it can go up with one final stressor and show up as disease, or it may actually just begin to resolve or go down if we have enough support in our lives or if we're addressing and resolving some of these things that have happened in the past. Mm-hmm. So that's how I see the beauty. You know, it's a difficult term to think of beauty in this, but the beauty of knowing this context is that chronic disease appears to be being run by a nervous system and a cell danger response that's gotten stuck, rather than because our genes are running the whole show, or because we have enzymes that are faulty, or some part of our bodies are broken. And as a result, it may all be reversible, or more reversible than we think.
Right.
And that's, yeah.
Yeah. And that's, and for me, that's the big thing here of why I'm continuing to kind of push down this, is because of what you're showing, you know, that it isn't just a, you know, some sort of, you know, miscalculation or miss, you know, step in the DNA, you know, it's something that you, you know, doesn't require, you know, extraordinary effort to go in and rewrite your own molecules, or, you know, in terms of it being a genetic fault, a genetic code defect, that there is a possibility of management from a psychological experience level, and that it's a real possibility, not just, you know, we talked about positive thinking on the last episode. This isn't about just positive thinking. Mm-hmm. This is about identifying what those triggers are that cause this physiological response to it. And which is why, like I, you know, I said, I reached back out to you, because after having had that conversation, and, you know, we didn't get into as much detail as you just did about that, but it was enough for me to sit there and go, now I'm going to take another path around the, you know, the world here. And I'm going to look at it very differently. And what is going to be interesting, and I want to share this with people that are watching this, because I, you know, I'm observing myself as you're talking about that. And as you go into the discussion of fight and flight, and you're saying, like, it could be these things out here in the environment that do it, my chest started to tighten again, because I was then reflecting on the thing that just happened to me very recently. And I'm feeling that. And so, I mean, that's what this is I'm feeling this physical response to this conversation. And I know that this physical response is the trigger, you know, for me. In the last episode, you know, I talked about a dating experience, this positive, like the dip switch went off in my head after having gone out, had a, you know, I sensed something wasn't quite right with the gentleman that I had, you know, had been seeing. And I brought it up, you know, at the dinner table of like just saying, hey, let's just pull this off the, you know, let's pull back the curtains. Let's talk about what's going on. And in the course of this conversation, I found the next morning that this pain that I've had in this wrist now, you know, for 2.5 years actually just finally went away. Like, and this pain started from a stress, you know, response in a work and personal life situation. And it was like, oh my gosh, like, I don't know what it was, but, you know, here it was. Well, sadly, after that episode was recorded, about a month later, the pain came back. And it came back when I got an email from my ex, who I'm presently in the process of divorcing. And the email pissed me off. I mean, it pissed me off, right? And so as soon as I got pissed again about that, the pain came back in the wrist. And then I've been battling it since then. But then I ended up in a situation, and I'm going to share this story, you know, very gingerly and tenderly, because I want it to be helpful for everybody, but I don't want it to be read as me pointing fingers at somebody else in a negative way. But I found myself in a situation with an individual who I began to recognize some personality characteristics that were familiar to me, and familiar to me in not good ways for me. And I went into fight mode again, but the difference was I also was in this, I felt myself stuck. And you talk about freeze in the sense that I felt all the, you know, felt it right here in my fist. And I, you know, and I started to recognize that when I get mad, my fist clench. And guess what? This is where the RA lives mostly, is in these two hands right here and these wrists. But I felt the chest tighten, the clench, and then me getting into this, I need to protect myself from this person. I'm not in any physical danger. You know, I'm not, there's no abusive situation, but it was just the fact that that coupled with, a week ago, I just published an episode where I talk with a woman who specializes in working with survivors of narcissistic abuse, and particularly the family dynamic where there is narcissism abounds, you know, where there's very self-centered parents and what that does to kids that grow up in an environment where the parent thinks more about their needs and, you know, is trying to like sequester, you know, the child's needs are hard to manage for themselves. Mm-hmm. And having grown up with that type of an environment where it went from doing everything that I needed to do to finally getting to the place of where I was just pissed off and I left, like I was just out, mm-hmm. I was out of the confines of that captive environment. I identified as being, you know, the scapegoat, the truth teller, the fighter, you know, the person who, when the family does get together, I am the person who does say something about what's going on and all that. Mm-hmm. And all those pieces came together. And I was like, okay, here I am in this situation with this person. This individual has triggered me. All the pain came back. I mean, I'm taking medication. It's been managing it, but it doesn't manage it when the situation comes back and now my body is going, no, I mean, who cares what medication you're taking? You're in danger. I need to protect you from this person that's around you. And the knuckles started to swell back up again. The wrist got really, really sore. And I actually had to let this person know that they need, no contact. I don't talk. I can't text. No, you know, because I was protecting my boundary there. But I had to come to that point of realizing what triggers me is not just stress. It is fighting and defending myself against a particular personality type that I have grown up fighting and defending myself against for my life. And at the same time, until of having this awareness, was gravitating at a subconscious level towards those people because of lacking the awareness of how the brain puts you into the familiar situations. Even if it's bad for you, the brain is looking out like, well, we know how to manage these people. So we're going to keep putting you back into those situations because that's what we've trained you to do. Childhood trained you to be in this environment. And so there you go. Well, the environment's toxic to me, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's where I came back to, like, I know where I'm at. So once I extricated myself, and I'm attempting to do that, but I'm still dealing with, you know, I set boundaries. Hey, this is the way I want to engage. And if you can do that, great. If not, this is done, you're out. And after having boundary violation after boundary violation after boundary violation, and also me going back into fight mode, you know, saying F you and all that stuff, I was finally like, you know what I need to do is I need to recognize that I don't need to fight and I don't need to be or, you know, identify. And my friend called it my early warning detection system. She's like, you know, sucky as it is, you've got an early warning detection system now. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, I kind of do, you know? And so while you're sitting there talking about, you know, this whole thing, it happens. Like I couldn't control the fact that while you're describing this, that all those feelings started to come back up of that instant response to this. I need to fight. Like, yes, Veronique, you're talking about the situations where I feel like it's an automatic response for me to do this. So I go talk to a rheumatologist and I've got to change my medication. I've broken through. We're trying a different course of medication because the wrist is probably disabling now. And I've got to go to therapy to get this fixed after 2.5 years of pain and inflammation. And we're trying to be aggressive about knocking that down. And I'm trying to have a conversation about, well, psychologically, doctor, I think that these other things are happening. And his answer is like, yeah, psychologically, there's probably some effect in there. And that's it. So anybody who's out there that's, you know, dealing with the chronic diseases and ailments, you know, and receiving medication, I believe we're missing this ability to say, well, how do we get a holistic treatment of it, which isn't really out there, right? I mean, dealing with the trauma and dealing with the physical ailments and working together to have those things come together is really a big gap, I believe, in the treatment of disorders like this. And I think that it's important. You know, that's why I said, let's, you know, come on and talk about this, because maybe this is the first step for many people if they aren't already going through therapy, is to understand that it'd be great to be able to have your physician and your therapist be able to, you know, work, have it be a process that works together. So I know going into therapy, my conversation is about rage. It's about this response to, you know, this type of personality and what I would need to work on myself in order to be able to modulate my responses to that social, I wrote it down, your social nervous system, mm-hmm. But also my sympathetic nervous system. Is it okay for me to be mad? Is it okay for me to feel defensive? But then how do I actually fight back in a way that's physically healthy for me to do it instead of wanting to actually punch somebody in the face? Which is what I really want to do, you know, because that's the primitive part of it, right? But that's not socially acceptable, although it might feel good. It also doesn't solve the problem. So I want to come back to how does somebody actually know what their sympathetic response really is if they've been brought up in an environment? I mean, I'm 47 years old. I've known I'm a fighter, but I'm only beginning to recognize that the fighting, my ability and my desire to fight has been sequestered or I've been submissive, and that submission of that, instead of feeling like I could stand up for myself in a positive and healthy way, is where my body builds it all up and it comes out in the form of pain. But I would imagine that as people grow up, they don't really know what their natural response is because, as you pointed out, freeze might be where they're stuck in. Is there a way to test to find out, like, how to unlock what your actual sympathetic response is to danger? Like, how do we identify that, like, in a true way?
I don't know if we need to identify specifically. It's a great question. I'm going to have to think about this. I can't think on my feet that moment with that specific question.
Yeah.
I have to let it simmer a little bit in the background. What I'd like to do is provide a little bit of context for what you're talking about, because in essence, when we hear about what your growing up was like, it's easy for some people to think that if you're thinking about that from the past and how things are acting right now, we can think that it's psychological. But as you're also saying, it's really something that's happening at a nervous system level. So it's not really about psychology. It might affect our psychology and how we feel and what we want to do and those kinds of things, but it's the nervous system piece. And what your system may have is a CDR, a cell danger response, that's stuck in one particular pathway and direction. And for you, it may be fight flight. The freeze part of it is that when you were in your family system growing up, you could not fight your way out of this. You could not talk your way out of this. You couldn't ask them to change and have a response happen where they actually did that. And there was threat to your system if you were seeing things and you were the truth teller when you spoke up or wanted to speak up. There were potential repercussions from that carried threat for you, whether it was that you had to take care of yourself. And for a child, children aren't able to survive on their own in the world. So that's a pretty big threat. And so that would have been giving your nervous system and your cell danger responses hits and things that it could not resolve. So there's the helpless freeze component is that you couldn't really actually act to do anything about it. And then finally something shifted and you were able to flee. Like you said, you left that family system and then you kept bumping into people with the similar patterns. The fact that you're aware of that, that's engaging one of the tools. This is a mindfulness piece where you can notice what the pattern is, who it is you're seeing, how it relates to your own threat response today, and then how it relates to threat responses that are similar from the past. What the research is suggesting is that it doesn't totally matter whether you're caught in sympathetic or if you're sort of stuck response is wanting to punch the daylights out of somebody. or whether what your system wants to do is set a boundary in a certain way, mm-hmm. or if you're stuck in a freeze state, which is what chronic fatigue looks like. Many chronic illnesses are going to have components of all of these, and they're going to be slightly different pathways for everyone. So the way of working with this, the mindfulness piece is actually huge, because when you're being mindful, you're actually engaging a part of your brain and nervous system that is not completely caught up in the fight response or the freeze response. Some part of you, even if it's 1% or 0.1%, is observing or witnessing what's happening in the rest of your system. the meditation traditions and also the body-based trauma therapies look at this as a way of helping your nervous system say, oh, we are not going to react. We're going to witness, we're going to observe, but we don't actually have to react. In this present moment, if I'm safe in this present day, if I'm not actually, if my life is not at threat or I don't actually have to run or fight, then I can actually watch this reaction and not react and not go into it. And that's actually how we begin to decrease the pathways that have gotten stuck in our nervous systems and I think at the cellular level. So this is where I think trauma therapies, somatically based trauma therapies, can be very helpful. We're not talking our way through this. I mean, you're talking because you've been paying attention to this for years, mm-hmm. and you can use the words and you can put point a finger on it because you've really been paying attention and you've started to catch this pattern. But if you start therapy with just saying, look, I have a chronic illness, maybe there's a trauma or adversity history that's happening, you may have no conscious awareness. And what's happening is that your nervous system is not something that you're going to have words for. And you're not going to access it from your brain, your thinking brain. You actually need to have what you just did, which was awareness of sensations. Mm-hmm. That's huge.
Yeah.
And the fact that you can track your sensations while I'm talking, maybe it builds a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Right here.
Right there.
Yeah.
Right in
yeah,
your chest.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yep. Yep.
And that you know that there's a fight response of wanting to punch someone. When we're working with this from a trauma therapy point of view, we actually slow it down because the goal is not to punch someone's lights out, but it is to let your nervous system feel it. Maybe it's see it in your own mind's eye. And that's part of how the nervous system will process what never got to happen, what needed to happen to set your boundaries or protect yourself. Mm-hmm. So even punching out pillows is a little over much. It can actually stimulate a sense of like, oh, I really did this. But it's often not done in a small enough way that you can really feel the part of your awareness that gets what it's like to do that action. The reason we slow it way down in trauma therapies, it's very scary to allow your fight response to actually start to move, because it was really risky when you were a child. You could not use this without getting, it sounds like, some kind of pushback mm-hmm. or risk to your system, even if that was just of being ignored or being put down or being called names or not even hurt physically. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that about your history. It's really about helping your nervous system find its own way, its unique path, because everyone's history is different, and feel what it's like to do that action or those series of actions that would have protected you or would have prevented harm or would have set up a boundary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we do that in a really slow way so that you don't send your system straight out into another freeze response or overwhelm. And so that's part of how trauma therapies work. So if you have a lot of rage, coming back to your question, really, if you have a sense that little things kind of trigger your own irritability, I remember once when I was in my medical training, I stubbed my toe on the door sill as I was walking into my house, and I wanted to kill somebody. I mean, I just stubbed my toe. I didn't even hurt my toe. I went from 0 to 100 in no time flat. So that's a fight response. And that's an indication that your system is really bottling some stuff and that there's some kind of impulse that's really been held back too much. And for me, my own medical training, not just the hours, not just the hard work, there was a lot of fear that I wouldn't do enough, that I wouldn't be able to prevent someone from dying, or that I wouldn't do things right, and one of the senior faculty trainers would light into me or shame me, or those ended up being some triggers for the onset of my own chronic illness. And so that fight response could have been one little clue back then. Mm-hmm. So that would be one way to tell if you have a fight response is, are you kind of constantly irritable, kind of constantly holding back? If little things that strangers do tick you off, then that's an indication that you may have a pathway in your system that isn't really resolved, that has some underlying unresolved sense of threat, and that it's responding from a fight-flight perspective.
Yeah, and it does. Yeah. You know, I know for me, and again, going back, and I've always known that anybody that, and I know this is going to sound really weird to say this, and would be probably odd for people to know that sometimes this is, you know, a feeling that I have in me, but certain types of emotionally needy people piss me off. And I don't want that to come off as like, I have no sensitivity to people's needs or no empathy for, you know, the fact that people need some, you know, tender, loving care and grace and understanding. It is a recognition, you know, for me, again, of, you know, this is a person whose needs, they're going to attempt to overwhelm my needs for their needs. Very different, right? You know, when somebody needs you, you know, our humanity and our compassion is all there. And I'm all in that. And people that actually know me know that that's the case. But, you know, get around a person who are, I'm like, you have so many of them and you don't have any capacity for anybody else's needs. It's all about your needs and having your needs taken care of at the expense of my needs. And those people, like, I cut them out, push them away, you know, especially if they were, you know, just kind of like more social things. And like, I don't even want to be around because of that, just being so mad about feeling like I've done it. I've had it. Like, I don't want any more of that taking care of everybody's effing needs and not my own needs, you know, kind of, and having my needs be just ignored. Like, you're fine, you know? And so that, you know, that little piece of the, of that rage, you know, and rage is, you know, I don't fly off the handle. Again, anybody that knows me don't knows that it's not like a constant in my life, but when it gets to a place of where I see that you don't see me and yet you want me to be 100% into what is going on in your world, then chest tightens, hands clench up, you know, the whole, the whole piece of it. And so when I'm having this conversation, you know, for anybody else that's out there in the RA world, I'm curious as to whether or not that's a typical response with other people that actually have rheumatoid arthritis. I'm just curious. I'm not saying that that is the response that everybody with RA has, but I am interested in knowing how many people out there have that, because we talked about, we don't know exactly, you know, at that cell danger response, why the synovial fluid is triggered or why it's, you know, impeded, because what's its role in this whole thing of fighting, you know, where, what's it do to shut it down or, you know, whatever it does physically in our hands if we're fighting. So I'm curious about, you know, is it fighters that have the disease? And maybe there's a way of then zeroing in of, you know, a little bit more of understanding that then why is the response with RA to do that to people? In that capacity. But I, like I said, for me, it was stress me out with a work-related task. Give me a mountain to climb. Give me a challenge to accomplish. Give me a million other things that would normally stress different people out. Those don't stress me. The stresses come right into a very, you know, archetypical person that was a part of identifying in my life. That right there, you know, like I feel like in the last month, I found it. I found that one thing that actually, and then when I go back and plot life over the last several years and realize that, you know, the culmination of the disease, the onset and the environment that I was in, I was immersed around that. And I want people listening to sit there and go, okay, now let's identify specifically, you know, what, you know, is there a particular person? Is it a particular event? And if I go back in there, can I actually start to link those together? And I know it's not psychological, but in some sense it is. Like it is that wiring, that trauma wiring, right? That formed the neurons and the connections in the brain that don't serve me today as the adult. You know, I'm not in danger. I can actually get out. And that's how I had to talk myself through this other, you know, that witnessing, I'm glad you pointed that out, because that's exactly what happened was, is I was in it and then I had to pull myself back out. And then I even had to take it back another step. I thought I was out far enough. Hey, I'm a fighter. This person's triggering me. I'm in it. But then I had to realize, wait, you wanting to send one more text message to to fight for your position or to reassert your boundary is you still in it. You need to take another step back out and go, you don't even have to do that. You've said it, you know where you're at, you know where you stand, just let it go. Like, you don't have to always be standing up for justice for yourself, which is really the kind of the key mode. Is punching is one thing, but the really, I want you to understand, you know, what you're doing and why it's wrong. Like, that's my real fight, you know, in there.
That piece of wanting to be understood is actually another part of a nervous system response. Imagine if your parents had gotten that they needed to work on their own patterns, where their own needs were so over prioritized that you were suffering, that you were having to do things on your own that children shouldn't really need to have to do. Imagine what it'd be like if they had actually gotten it. If it actually gone into their systems and they had worked through their own trauma that led them to be that way. Mm-hmm. It's sort of this, all these different pieces, like it's like spokes of a wheel in a way. They're all different parts of your particular pathway, but they're very common for a lot of folks. And you mentioned this particular type of person that drives you nuts and that really elicits a very strong fight response and that you have no tolerance for. That kind of neediness is a different threat response. Those kind of folks grew up in a family system that wasn't taking care of their needs either. And if they have no awareness of it, then there's a certain quality of grasping and of desperation of life. It's like their life is at stake. That's the degree, that's the sort of an underlying quality behind that degree of need. And that can be really overwhelming. It's overwhelming in their own system because that's what they grew up with that led to threat. And then it's overwhelming to ours when we're interacting with someone in that kind of state. So part of your own process is also, and my own process is learning, if I actually set a boundary, can I trust it? Because if we set a boundary and we can trust that we've sent that one text, something in our own nervous system will shift. And then we won't have to use psychology or willpower or mindfulness to make sure that we don't send that second text. Our nervous systems will actually go, or that 10th text.
Yeah, right. You get the point across. I want to get the point across.
Exactly. If we actually work with our nervous systems to the point where the brain gets the message, oh, that person got it. They're not going to threaten our boundaries. We're actually holding this boundary and no one's going to run over it anymore. My life is not at risk anymore. Then the cell danger response and the fight flight response will actually come back down completely back to normal. And then we're done. Like, it's complete and we can walk away and there's nothing left. There's no residual tension or anger or whatever. Right. In a healthy system, that's what it can do. Mm-hmm. And when we have a chronic illness, it's that our systems are stuck and that's what we're having to work with to help our systems keep finding their way back.
Right. Now, and I want to say that, and you're describing perfectly here, because it happened. I went through this arched peak of intensity, anger, boundary violations, holding the boundaries and, you know, the body, you know, I mean, this was probably one of the worst flare-ups I've had in a few years. You know, the hands, the wrist, you know, I started to feel the ache in the shoulder. I didn't have a full-blown palindromic, you know, pain that I've had before, but everything was coming in and it raised concern in me of like, you know, again, anger of like, I'm, you know, I'm pissed off that I'm around somebody that's damaging my body. Like, that makes me mad. Mm-hmm. But then going through this awareness, this, and then saying, listen, what's different today is that you now know, and you can actually hear the boundaries. Here's what you can do. Here's how you get here. Again, here's how you extricate. You don't have to be, this is a choice. I didn't have to be engaged with this person. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't tied to them in any way. I could disengage, be honest with my feelings, because that was the other part I struggled with, is like, I don't, you know, that initial, I can't express what I want because I'm concerned about what the response will be. That's the growing up piece of saying, I have something I need to tell you, but every time I do, it's either completely ignored or I'm yelled at or, you know, disregarded or whatever it is, or, you know, at a smaller level, you know, the danger of, you know, it's going to upset the balance of the family so much that it's chaos for everybody. And I'm not in that place anymore. You know, as an adult, it's like, you know, that was the old thing. And seeing that that's the case, like, I, you know, you're not a kid anymore. You can actually do it and do it for you. It doesn't matter what their response is. If they give you the response that you're afraid they're going to give you, you've just confirmed your assessment of what's going on, and be okay with that, because, you know, who cares? If they don't, well, then maybe and that was part of the doubt, was like, well, maybe I'm wrong about this. But as I went through that, and again, once I asserted that boundary and made that, like, you've done it, you've hold it, trust it, like you said, then all the pain started to recede. Now, it didn't go all the way away, which is the follow-up, which is that piece of, I was able to modulate it from that emotional nervous system, you know, controlling the body and everything like that. But then at the end of the day, rheumatoid arthritis is in my cells. It's in my body right now. And once it kicks in and the pain starts in, then I have to do some medical interventions, you know, in order to get the, you know, the response, to get the pain out of it, or it's not worth risk being disabled, you know, over all of this and stuff. And so it's that, you know, partnership in there. But I was like, oh my gosh, like, that was the other piece that made me excited about talking to you again, was like, okay, I actually did work myself back off the cliff and back down. And I brought my physical body back to a place, and I hadn't seen the doctor yet. I hadn't changed my medication. It all happened outside of the realm of the medication. And it happened in concert with this engagement and this interaction that I was having through this experience. And I was like, there is something here. Like, there really is something, you know, in here. And I'm excited about that. And I'm hoping that other people can start to, you know, come into this mindfulness, because, you know, like you said earlier, I think there is a way. I think we are getting closer to a way to being able to take a, you know, an ailment like this. And when we start connecting all those pieces together, actually bringing some sincere relief to folks that are suffering from this disease, it is a terrible thing. Like, I hate to say terrible negative words, but it sucks to be in pain all the time. It sucks to know that, you know,
it does.
Your engagement with the world now, that you know that certain things out there at the emotional level are going to trigger that. I mean, I like I said, I get angry about the idea that sometimes I'm going to run into people that are going to affect me so physically that if I don't get this under control, I'll be disabled because of it. Do you know how effing irritating and angry that makes me think? And then to sit there and go, okay, and why, you know, am I a bad person? I mean, so there is this emotional piece to it, and I want this to go away, and I want other people to be liberated, you know, from this possibility themselves. That's my soapbox.
Yours and millions of others, really,
right?
Because in a way, that rage, that someone else's way of behaving can make me disabled. That's part of how this works. And really what it goes back to is that we grew up in family systems where there's no awareness, where we may be completely loved, but the lack of awareness of certain patterns affecting the child's nervous system and the child's long-term health are happening. And really, it's so unrecognized in our society that it's really deeply, profoundly frustrating and at some level enraging. And so what I find so helpful about what you just talked about is you can take medications to buy yourself time. At the very least, you're buying yourself time while you work through these patterns. That's one way to think about it, if mm-hmm. this is something you want to explore. And you can still work through these patterns while being on medications. That's another thing that you're naming. Like, you're still seeing and witnessing these patterns, and you're still being able with your own work to bring things down, mm-hmm. which is so huge. I have to say that it's totally exciting for me too, to witness that. Like, holy cow, you know? Yeah. And I think that's the power of having a context like this, is there's not one pathway out. There are so many people who have recovered in different ways. Some people recover from RA through diet. They take gluten out, or they clean up the carbs, and that's enough to actually fully recover from their rheumatoid disease, which is kind of huge. Mm-hmm. This is one of the 10 different tools I talk about, is that there are many different ways of quieting down the cell danger response. If you can give your body a little bit or a lot of space, it's actually designed to heal on its own. If we had enough support as kids, maybe if there was another adult outside the family system that saw what was going on or that understood it or that could support our parents to work through their own pieces, we might actually have resolved that cell danger response way back then. Mm-hmm. But even now, years or decades later, we can still begin to address that. And so the way I think about an approach to treatment using this perspective is planting seeds to decrease our system's load, decrease the stress load. So that can be through diet. It can be through exercise. Like, exercise also helps oxygenate the system, bring in oxygen. Mm-hmm. That may be an issue that a lot of us are struggling with, that our mitochondria are struggling with. And so if you find a way to do some kind of movement within your own capacity, even if it's just moving your arms around because you're not able to take walks or whatever it is, that's another piece. The meditation piece actually calms our nervous systems down at certain levels. Like for me in the early days, I could not meditate without going down the rabbit hole into more freeze.
Right.
You know, so I was immobilizing in a meditation state and it was triggering more deepening of my freeze stillness state. So that I can do it now that my nervous system is more online, the social nervous system is more online. But so as you add things up, it creates more space in your system so that it can actually resolve this on its own. And every little bit that we do adds up. Just mm-hmm. like all the different hits from our life experiences contribute to risk for disease or emotional states like depression or PTSD, all the seeds that we plant that are resources actually help our nervous systems regain their hierarchy and health, so that our systems can go in whatever direction they need to do and then come back down into that place where things can be calm when there is no threat.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Absolutely. Now, again, this is kind of focused on RA, and I feel like it was a little focused on me because I have RA, sharing experiences again with hopefully the idea that somebody can identify or, you know, maybe begin to link together some of their own experiences and observations through my story and, you know, the pieces. And I'm not saying that, you know, everybody out there with RA is, you know, comes from a certain family dynamic. I'm curious. And that's why I said, you know, at the end of the show, you know, I want you to come to my website. I'll have a link there that you'll allow you to just kind of fill out a brief survey. My curiosity's got the best of me. I'd like to see where it actually goes, because like you said, I'm excited too about, you know, being outside of myself and not just being carried along in life by the disease, but actually saying, you know, it's the fighter in me, right? The fighter in me, I'm turning it towards myself and fighting for myself in a different way. And so as I'm going down this path, my own rabbit hole with you, and I'm finding some things that I think that are important for people, then I want to know more about what other people are experiencing out there. And so, you know, being able to share that and then going to your website as well for the other resources, I'd like to see how everybody kind of is starting to link these things together. You know, you said early in the interview, and I've actually had somebody on my show that we talked about somatic therapy. Can you talk about that? Because I think when people, let's imagine somebody that actually has a chronic physical ailment, and they are also noticing that it ebbs and flows with their response to the environment, and that their physical body kind of manifests, you know, the flare-ups and whatnot for whatever the chronic disease that they have there. I didn't know about somatic therapy before this journey, but now I'm looking at it like that is actually, to me, that seems like a very strong modality for somebody who is wanting to, again, make the combination of here's the medical interventions from the doctor and the rheumatologist and the medications with the therapeutic response to, you know, to kind of going through the trauma recovery and stuff like that. So can you talk about what somatic therapy is and what that looks like for somebody that might leave the show going, that's what I need to be looking into?
I never knew about somatic psychotherapies when I was a physician either. And they're very different from cognitive behavioral therapies, for example, which is the most common form of therapy when we talk about going to therapy. And cognitive behavioral therapy is generally oriented towards cognition or thinking and helping us change our beliefs. And so maybe shifting from negative thinking to positive thinking. And these can be helpful in some places, but talking does not access the nervous system perceptions of threat. We can talk all we want, but we actually have to learn how to speak the language of the body. So somatic psychotherapies include things like EMDR, eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing. It used to be that you're working with your eyes to what they think is crossing to the different sides of the brain. That is a therapy that is kind of working with the body and the nervous system and how it is able to process information. The therapies that I trained in are Peter Levine has written a book called Waking the Tiger. He's written a few since then, but he's the founder of Somatic Experiencing, or SE. There's also sensory motor psychotherapy. Pat Ogden is the primary founder of that modality. And there are some others that I name on my site. So when you do a session with someone like this, they have a lot of this context already. They're familiar with polyvagal theory in general. They're familiar with this hierarchy of how the nervous system works. And so they're helping you learn how to notice where your system is. Am I in freeze and dissociated right now? Am I in the fight-flight mode where I really want to mobilize? Am I actually have a sense of connection or a sense of safety? And then they help you work with that by watching the intelligence, listening to the intelligence of your body, because your body knows how to find its way out. So when I was practicing psychotherapy in this way, what I so appreciated was just how much intelligence there is. It's part of why I left medicine. I felt as though there was more intelligence, and I really wanted to find out how do I work with that to help someone be empowered to work through their own peace, using what their body knows that no one else knows. So it's a bit like being a midwife and trusting the person who's the client, trusting their system to show you the way. And there are skills that will help someone not go too fast, not have to relive the whole trauma thing, not have to get caught in the same old patterns. And so there's a lot of perspective in these somatic psychotherapies about chronic disease. I don't know at this point how many of us are trained with working with chronic illness. I think this is a fairly new way of thinking. I mean, decades, but not hundreds and hundreds of years. And so finding someone and then working with them may take some practice for both you and the therapist, because there's a learning curve. When I was working with folks with chronic illness, one of the things I really had to learn the hard way was, when someone has a chronic illness, the amount of history, the things that have stacked up on top of each other, generally tends to be fairly significant. And so you really want to work in very, very small doses. And when I'm a client and I see a therapist in somatic psychotherapy, I just want like to get this over with. Like, just fix me. Just help me move through this as fast as possible so I can get this over with. Brené Brown has a wonderful YouTube video on how she's talking about this. Actually, it might be an article. She went to the therapist and said, let's just get through this. You know, six sessions, let me be done.
Right.
But it tends to take a little more time than that, because you do need to go slowly enough. The way they talk is that less is more, slower is faster, mm-hmm. so that your system can actually integrate as it goes and not get re-triggered into these different pieces. And so that's another piece about somatic psychotherapies, is they can work in a very gentle, very respectful way that trusts and helps you learn how to trust your own system. And that doesn't look as your illness as being like the problem. Mm-hmm. It's really that it's a reflection that your system is caught in some way.
Yeah.
That address some of what you're wondering about,
Jimmy? It is. Yeah. And the episode, the current episode that's out there right now, is about neuroscience. And so the other piece of this is that this will dovetail really nicely for anybody that wants to hear a neuroscientist talk about neuroplasticity and, you know, in that. And so I think that now it's like, okay, now there's a, you know, there are therapies available that talk about the nervous system. They talk about the body's response to this and why does this work? Well, you know, go back an episode and listen to my episode on neuroscience and you'll actually see that what we now know in terms of how brain architecture is established and how the, you know, you can prune out old neuro connections and form new neuro connections. You know, and you can do that through thought and response, but then also, like I said, once I heard about somatic and I began to actually pay attention, I was so externally focused on what is going on around me, you know, that causes pain, that then I started to feel, how do I feel when those responses happen? And it's the onset, because my chest tightened first before my joints started to hurt. That was the thing, was like, when I felt that, and then within a couple of days, now the RA was kicking in and the flare-up was kicking in. And it was like, okay, now all these pieces are coming together. And that's why I wanted you to bring that up about somatic, because it's there. Like, you know, you might know, you'll get your own early warning detection system. You know what I mean? Because that's what I've got. Is that, you know, yeah, I will... Knowing all these pieces there allows me to, okay, because I don't think we're going to shut off our threat, right? When we run into somebody or some circumstance that's going to trigger us, you know, like my own therapist told me, we'll never be able to make them all go away, but we can neutralize many of them that happen to you. And the, you know, like you talk about the pacing's going to be slow because as an adult, the neuroplasticity just isn't, you're not learning new things as quickly as you were as a child. And that's that balance of, you learned an awful lot as a little kid and a lot of it got planted in there very early because your brain was ready for it. The sponge that your brain was took it all in. And now you're at a state where you probably have to go back in and just, you know, and pull some of that out. And it's just going to take you more time to get it out of the brain than it did to put it in, you know, back when you were 3 years old or 5 years old or, you know, 16 or whatever.
I don't know if that's entirely a learning thing, although it is harder to learn when there's a history of trauma. Mm-hmm. I think of it as, yes, certain things really did sink in more to our brains when we were kids. Mm-hmm. And they also got stuck there more because that's how our system decided and learned how to orient to the world. But I think with trauma, it can actually happen very, very quickly. The work is slow so that we don't trigger a repeat overwhelm or a repeat trauma response. But the neural connections can actually shift instantaneously.
Oh, I agree with that. Yeah. I 100% have felt that once a feeling or once a moment, a memory or whatever it was is neutralized, it's neutralized, like it's done. And I don't know if that is just me because I'm just so hyper, you know, into this stuff. But I do totally agree with that. I'm amazed at myself, you know, and not patting myself on the back, but just reflecting back that in, you know, short of 13 months of therapy and even doing this, like, you know, the podcast show has allowed me to get unfairly, I'll admit it, totally unfair that I get the benefit of talking with so many different therapists and so many different professionals and experts that most people don't get that experience. And I've learned from every one of them that, and maybe that's how in a year, it's still taken a year, but I can tell you that it's been profoundly different. And even then I still get, like I said, I still have these experiences that, you know, trigger me in a certain way, but a year ago, this experience would have been a totally different response. I wouldn't have seen the danger. I would have just gone headlong into the danger and not stopped myself and said, no, boundaries, you know, because there were no boundaries before. So I do agree, you know, but you're right in the terms of you can't find everything quickly. And I've even in my brain where I've opened it up and I've said, find it all, let's go for it. I still discover the hidden pieces of it that are still, like I said, you know, the anger and the rage piece of it is only materializing out of it. I think after kind of digging through everything else of getting to a place of like, there's still some unresolved, you know, we're 1 year into this. And even though I'm, you know, pushing ahead with all the strength and, you know, and determination to do it, there's still going to be more to uncover as we go through this and, you know, and everything comes together. So, absolutely. I can't say that enough to everybody. Once you find it and you neutralize it, it really is that fast. Like you just are like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I've been carrying that piece of baggage with me for so long. And once I decided it was gone, it was gone. And it's liberating, you know?
And there's nothing wrong with threat responses. We want to have our threat responses work. If we do run into a bear in the woods tomorrow, we want those threat responses to work. We just don't want them stuck in high gear and hypervigilance so that they're always on when they don't need to be.
Right, right. Yeah. And, you know, and I've heard people, you know, and I guess I want to say this too, you know, some folks call it like it's the saber-toothed tiger and that, you know, our primitive responses have no place in the world. That's not true. We are always going to be around danger. Our danger is not the same as the saber-toothed tiger, but let's not dismiss the fact that we have a danger response. Our brain is looking out for us. It's wanting to save us and protect us. That might be primitive. It may be the you know, the first brain, you know, the brain stem and the first part of our brain that came online as a human, but it's not irrelevant. And we're not talking about sequestering, you know, the fact that our bodies can detect danger for us. It's talking about tuning it so that it's appropriate from what it learned as danger as a child to what danger really is to you as an adult. And that those two things, you know, our childhood environments are not always what we find ourselves as adults, especially in a shifting culture and society that we have. It's so different there. That's the difference. We're not saying it's inappropriate to respond and get pissed about something or be afraid of something. That's always going to be there and has to be there. Because you know, we are going to be confronted with danger, you know, and sometimes danger is people that are going to abuse you, you know, emotionally and sometimes physically. And we as adults still run into those people. So that primitive response is totally applicable. And that's my other soapbox there. Cause they hear people like, well, yeah, you know, we don't have saber-toothed tigers. No, of course we don't have a saber-toothed tiger, but we still got scary people in scary situations and we need to be able to, you know, react at a moment's notice about that and do it, you know, that is appropriate for what we're doing today.
Mm-hmm. If you think about the importance of the threat response, I love how you were linking this in a way to chronic illness. I think of a chronic disease as actually being our bodies trying to take care of us. They're actually doing their damnedest as a result of being stuck in a survival mode that actually helped us survive circumstances in the past that could have killed us. And instead, they chose this other route. Our bodies chose this other route to... it's at a cost, at the cost of symptoms, but we're still alive. And now we have time to work through this so that we might be able to return back to this healthy place. And so the idea that a chronic disease could actually be your best friend and your most loyal supporter is a way I like to think about my illness. I forget about that 90% of the time. But when I think about this perspective, I have learned so much and I have become a different person because of it. And I have learned how to think about myself and my system and my body as actually having intelligence instead of the way that a lot of our culture will denigrate people or things or symptoms. And so I've really appreciated that part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. That is a great way. Like I said, when my friend called it my early warning detection system, right? And it's like, yeah, you're right. Like it's hyper vigilant. And it's looking out for me, but you know, it's not that I want to keep it with me the whole time, right? I'd like some other vigilance. But yes, you're correct. I, you know, it is. And I think that for anybody else that, you know, hasn't and is experiencing it themselves. I mean, if you think about it, like it is the cells, it is the beautiful makeup of our cells, seeing things out there that we aren't consciously seeing right now. Mm-hmm. And waking up to what our cells are telling us about that world. And I know that's what I've done. I've been listening to it in a different way rather than just medicating it and bitching about it, but saying, what is it telling me about me? And it is showing me parts of my world that I never knew. It's helping me reveal and grow as a person. You know, every little experience now is different. I'm not just responding to it and reacting to it. It's informing everything and it is powerful. And, so yes, I think, saying that it's your buddy rather than your enemy and regarding it in that way, maybe this will help other people not only come to the emotional terms with it, being diagnosed with a chronic illness, you know, is devastating. I mean, it really is. It's devastating to know that, you know, I have another friend who is, coming to terms with the fact that, you know, she likely has RA. She's already gone in through the first round of testing, but hasn't had like the anti-CCP test done. And it's devastating when you're, when the medications, you know, the new one that I'm taking, read the label, lymphoma, you know, all the other diseases that come with it. And those are scary.
Yeah.
But 5 years of being, you know, having, deformation occur if you don't treat it, and within 10 years possibly becoming disabled, that's a bummer. And so, you know, getting that whole thing and going, man, and why, again, I go back to that first statement, it kind of pisses me off that, you know, it was other circumstances and, you know, and other people. But on the other hand, you're right, it's just an incredibly empathetic body that we ended up inheriting that feels and sees the world so much more strongly than we can. And it's been life-changing in good ways, you know, and so I'm not going to say I'm grateful for it, but man, right. Yeah. I'm here with you and we're having a conversation, and I know other people that have been suffering from this disease are going to have a great outcome from this conversation. That's a powerful thing to me, and it wouldn't have happened without the diagnosis. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want you to go back to your website and talk about how to find you and what resources are there so that everybody at the end of it is like, yes, now I want to learn more. So bring us back home to what the work that you're doing.
You can go to my website by looking up chronicillnesstraumastudies.com. It'll take you to a homepage that has an overview of most of the important articles on my blog, the different kinds of trauma, so that you can get a sense of whether your past history, if you're kind of thinking, could this have actually had an effect on my developing an illness, you can look through those posts. If you click in the upper right-hand corner, you'll get to the regular menu page. And from there, I would go to the tools section. And if you're looking for a therapist, my blog post called Therapies for Nervous System Perceptions of Threat, that talks about different types of somatically based therapies for working with trauma and from a nervous system perspective. And it's looking at general kinds of trauma from childhood, accidents, surgery, anesthesia, abuse. But it's also has lists of therapies that can be very specialty oriented in the sense that birth events, if you were born breech or premature or in an incubator, some of these events add a whole other layer of difficulty. So there are approaches for working with that. And on that page, you'll find lists, links to directories of therapists around the world so that you can look for someone in your area or who Skypes or who seems like a good fit for you. And I talk about a few pointers about how to pick a therapist. In that therapies post, there will also be links to books on this, like some of the books that I find the most helpful, and you list some on your website as well. Mm-hmm. Just help have this context so that you can start to look at how to approach your health from a different point of view. If you want to know the science, look under the menu header disease studies. And under those studies, I have posts on each of these different kinds of trauma or environmental stressors. The one that's the most well-known right now or becoming increasingly recognized is adverse childhood experiences. And I have a series of posts on this. And one of them has a one-page fact sheet. You can print that out. You could give it to your doctor. You could give it to family members. It summarizes the research and really validates how this is not a psychological thing. It actually affects your genes. It affects the cell danger response. So I have references on that. And there are also 5 journal articles. If you really wanted to start a conversation with your doctor or just maybe open your doctor's eyes a little bit, you could print out any one of these 5 articles and give them. They're journal articles. They're totally medical. They have all the references. They're written in a way that a doctor, a medical doctor, would relate to and respect. So those are some of the major places to look at on my site. And also under the studies, I do also talk about the mechanisms. So I have a couple posts on the cell danger response and an introductory post on epigenetics and what it is and why disease might be reversible, like what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then if you want to contact me, if you go to the About menu header, the contact section is right at the bottom.
Right. And you have a Facebook group too, because I know that we've engaged through Facebook and I've met many people in your community that are kind of jumping into the One Broken Mom community through Facebook. So, and so what's the Facebook page?
It's Chronic Illness Trauma Studies.
Okay. That's pretty easy.
It's not a what?
I said, that's pretty easy. That's pretty straightforward.
It's not a closed group. Yeah. I mostly just post relevant articles that are coming out in the research and in literature and all over the web.
Yeah. And what I like about Facebook for people is sometimes it's sourcing community and sourcing a way of being able to have discussions with other people. It, you know, I mean, we're used to in a platform like this kind of talking at folks and wondering if they're listening. And I like getting responses back and emails back. And some people have sent me some emails related to the podcast that we've done already. But Facebook is good sometimes to link up with other people and to just share. And I find that, you know, a lot of people sometimes just want to tell me their story. And so,
yeah.
Sometimes just being witnessed, you know, throwing it out there. So, and I'll have the link in the podcast notes to your Facebook page as well so that people can actually jump in on that too. Well, Veronique, I appreciate you so much. I mean, in like a multitude of ways, and thank you for taking the time again to talk with me about this and kind of tapping into it. I mean, I was excited to share like my own discoveries there and was hoping that maybe there was something that we could, you know, work together to see if it can't start to, you know, maybe change some other people in terms of shifting perspective of their observation of themselves, the way the disease affects them physically, their, you know, and seeing if maybe they can't start to zero in, because you're right, everybody's experiences are different. My story and what triggered me may not be actually what other people are triggered by. But if it's similar, or if they can start to find it in, then being able to, you know, have a multi-layer holistic approach to treating the disease and subduing it, if not even reversing it in many ways, I think would be an amazing outcome. And I think that with all the changes in terms of what we're starting to see in research and studies, and people like you, quite honestly, that are finding all the studies and coalescing them together, we can, you know, I mean, I'm optimistic to say that in the next 10 to 20 years, mm-hmm. I think that there'll be an extreme management, if not, eradication. You know, I said, I'm not planning on, you know, eradicating rheumatoid arthritis, but you know what? Give me that challenge. And if I work towards it, like that's my intent, then I'm going to work towards my intent. I'm not going to sell myself short here.
Oh, but yes.
You know, it's like, right. It's like, I'd like to eradicate this disease, period. That's what I want people to do. And so thank you for coming in and having us talk about this and sharing what you know about this and, you know, hopefully for some other people. And again, you know, when you hear this podcast, by the time it's actually published, go to amiqueerconi.com. There'll actually be a link for you with just a very small survey. Like I said, I would just love to hear from you. I would love to know if you have RA, just some brief points, about your life and stuff so that I can actually start to collect all of that together so that again, it can be used to maybe inform a larger discussion. So, again, Veronique, I think I said this already, but I appreciate you coming on and talking with me today.
I've really appreciated it. This is great to be able to share this process together from different chronic diseases too. So it's really, really enjoying this and appreciating it. I mean,
awesome. Cool. Thank you for listening to One Broken Mom. You can find podcast notes on my website at amiqueerconi.com, and there I'll provide all links to all of the resources that we mentioned on the episode. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for other episodes, feel free to send me an email. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show, I'd love to have you be a part of the team. Finally, if you like what you hear, please share the podcast and leave a review so that others can find it. We are all here to get better together. I am the host, Ami Quirconi, and as always, I am super grateful to have you as a listener. Until next time, have a great day.